Please note, this episode contains descriptions of domestic violence, addiction, overdose, molestation, child pornography, and physical child abuse, including asphyxiation, bondage, and malnutrition. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to another episode of Trafficked. Today's interviewee is someone I can't wait for you to meet. His name is Jerome Elam, and Jerome is raising his voice in such an important way. It's especially essential for men who are survivors to join this conversation, and for us here on the show to feature those brave men. Because without it, we can't provide an accurate representation of what's occurring in this today. Jerome, thank you so much for being here.
Cheryl, thank you so much. It's such an honor. You know, and you know, you're such an inspiration to me. I just admire your courage in speaking out about what happened to you. Again, you know, we both know people who go through their entire lives and never break the silence about what happened to them, you know, how they were sexually assaulted and traumatized. And both of us, I think, didn't realize, you know, the burden we were bearing until we broke our silence. And I think the life that we've been able to achieve today, I mean, it what we had before just pales in comparison, because there's just a depth to the happiness I think we both feel after we've broken our silence that makes it extremely worth it. You know, it's extremely hard work to deal with what happened. But I think, you know, again, I think we're both here as beacons of light and hope as to what you can achieve if you just speak out and talk about what happened.
That, Jerome, you've put that so beautifully. I saw this quote yesterday that I'd never heard before. And it reads, "There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you." It's from Maya Angelou. And you're right. So many people never tell a soul. Each time I speak, somebody comes up to me. Oftentimes it's 10 or more people. This is not hyperbole. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing when you actually speak. Someone comes up and starts with, "I've never told this to anybody."
Yep.
So
no. Exactly. I mean, you know, Cheryl, there was so many times, but you know, I was at a conference in Baltimore a few years ago, and I had a 76-year-old woman for the first time come to me and say she had been, you know, trafficked and molested as a child. So, you know, what an incredibly rewarding experience to have someone who's had that pain inside them for so many years, you know, begin to talk about it. And, you know, I think both of us, I mean, you can see that weight lift off of people when they talk about this. I mean, and you know, tears that come down their cheeks. And I just am like, well, this is why God put me here and really uses me as an instrument to help others. Because, you know, to see people just let go of that and understand. And I think one of the qualities that we both have is, I mean, people who have been victims feel very comfortable speaking with us because they know we understand. And I think that's been something so instrumental in the work that we both do, but I've also been very honored in the work I've done with law enforcement and others to help them step in the shoes of a victim and understand, you know, what they go through and how to best help them, how to best recognize those that are out there, you know, being sold and being taken advantage of, so they can offer them the help they need to get out of that life.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to returning the conversation to that and the work that you're doing today. But to provide some context for that, take us back, if you will, to your life before this all occurred. So when you were a child, you know, prior to the age of five, will you share that with us?
Absolutely, sure. You know, what I say when I speak is that, you know, I was essentially born into a world of dysfunction. You know, my mother was an alcoholic, you know, pregnant at 17. You know, she herself came from an environment where she was, you know, raped by her father, physically abused. So it was a cycle that just kept perpetuating itself. So my mother became pregnant and gave birth to me, and she continued drinking, continued going along, and then eventually, you know, married a man. And my first memory as a three-year-old is the sound of this person's fist hitting my mother's face. But that marriage didn't last very long and soon fell apart. So my mother's drinking escalated, and we then moved back in with her parents, which was going from the frying pan into the fire. I mean, her father was a cruel person, you know, physically abusive. And so I suffered another level of hell that I didn't expect. Now, this would go on for several years. And during that time, you know, my mother would disappear for days at a time out on drinking binges. Then one day, my mother came home with a man that we thought was the answer to our prayers. I mean, he bought us gifts, took me to sporting events, was really kind. But what happened was after about 6 months of my mother dating this man, he began to molest me. Now, the way that he kept my silence, like in so many cases, is he threatened my mother's life. Now, it doesn't matter how big a train wreck your parents are. As a child, you do anything you can to protect your parents. So he secured my silence by threatening my mother's life. Then after about 6 months of molesting me, he began to use me for child pornography. Then after about 3 months of using for child pornography, he introduced me to the pedophile ring he belonged to. And so as my initiation to the pedophile ring that he belonged to, I was raped and beaten by all 10 members. So the first time I was trafficked at the age of 5, I was handcuffed to a truck stop bathroom and then raped by a procession of 5 men and 1 woman. And we were often given, even at that age, drugs and alcohol to make us more compliant. So my life as a victim of human trafficking began that day. It would last for a total of 7 years.
God, Jerome, I'm just so sorry. Words are insufficient. So did you continue going home then in between?
Yes, you know, one of the things... Yeah, one of the things, Cheryl, that and this is unfortunately far too common, you know, 36% of victims are trafficked by their families. So I had, you know, the facade of a normal life. I mean, I went to school, and went to a home. But, you know, on weekends and holidays, and we pulled out of school, you know, I was being sexually trafficked. So this went on during this whole time. And, you know, they maintained this window dressing that I was a normal child, but I was just a shell of a human being as I was being trafficked.
And at this tender age, 5 through 12, so you're going to school. Do any of the guidance counselors or school, you know, authority figures in any way suspect anything is happening? Are there any signs or indications you're giving off?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely signs. But, you know, Cheryl, you know, this is during the 1960s, 1970s. So there was like zero awareness. So no one really knew what to look for. But one of the things I tell people is that, you know, one of the depraved things that people used, that these individuals used to do that paid to molest me, was they would choke you unconscious. So they really... It excited them to be able to choke a child unconscious. So I would go into school and I would have finger marks on my neck. So I would button up my collar so no one could notice. But there were definitely signs of abuse there. But again, during that time period, no one really knew what to look for. So I was essentially invisible.
If they did know what to look for, what would they have looked for? Meaning,
oh gosh,
today, what could people check for? So there's the finger marks on the neck. What else?
Bruising, malnourished, anxiety, anger, frequent absences from school. I mean, today, you know, we look for what we call burner phones, which are mobile phones that you pay for, that they're untraceable. Hotel key cards. Today we look for social media profiles that are sexually suggestive. But a lot of it, Cheryl, as you know, is just a gut feeling. So you've really got to trust your instincts. When you feel like a child, needs help, and ask that important question. Do you need help? You know, is someone hurting you? So you've really got to look for the signs. But again, above all else, just trust your gut.
That is invaluable. Now, Jerome, before we resume with your story, when you ask a child, are you in trouble? Do you need help? Is someone hurting you? What happens when they, like you, were threatened with something that is keeping them silent? How can you tell if they say no, if they mean yes, in fact?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, if the signs are there and you really get the sense that they're covering for somebody or not telling the truth, you've got to just stick with it and let the proper authorities know. Unfortunately, one of the things that we see quite often is that, you know, when a child does disclose, you've got that one opportunity to get them out of the situation, because oftentimes, you know, the family may even be involved, or the family may want to just keep it quiet for, you know, an unfortunately sense of embarrassment. So you've got to help that child, you know, speak out in any way you can. Now, I work with a lot of child advocacy centers, and, you know, forensic nurses are just invaluable in terms of looking for the physical signs of a child being molested or abused. But again, you've got to look for that the psychology of it, you know, how they're being groomed, manipulated, their silence is being kept. So you've got to keep paying attention. But, you know, Cheryl, kindness is such an important tool. So if you're really kind to a child, because I know, you know, one of the things that I say in my story, which made me so vulnerable, is that, you know, I was desperate for affection as a child, like a drowning man's desperate for oxygen. So being kind to a child and just showing interest and showing that you care can really help them unlock, you know, that pain and really talk about a horrific situation that they're in.
Thank you, Jerome. So back to your story. And this is going on from 7 to 12. Does the man ever marry your mother? Is he your stepfather? Is he just someone who's there all the time?
So there all the time. And just, you know, the family essentially are enablers by just, you know, not acknowledging what's going on. I mean, it's such a, you know, it's such a dysfunctional environment. You know, Cheryl, it's just people, you know, when you come from a dysfunctional setting, I mean, there's such chaos that just swirls around you. So people really just aren't concerned with, you know, a child being so horrifically abused. And they just kind of stand by and let it happen. So my mother, you know, again, chose to numb out using alcohol. I mean, I knew that she knew what was going on, but she denied it
to her death.
Yeah, she denied it to her deathbed. But, you know, alcohol was just so convenient for her, you know, to hide herself in the bottom of a bottle. So you just kind of realize that, you know, there's that sense of hopelessness in terms of anybody actually listening to you.
Wow. Okay. So what occurred at 12 to get you out of this life?
Well, you know, Cheryl, up until that point, I mean, I tried to tell a total of 10 people. And one of those people was an emergency room doctor. Now, when you're a victim of human trafficking, often you're given a fake identity, so you can't be traced back to the trafficker, your parents, or anybody by the police. So on one occasion, I was given a fake identity, and I didn't respond to the name quickly enough, so I was actually thrown to the floor and kicked in the ribs by the leader of the pedophile ring. So I actually was taken to the emergency room with 3 bruised ribs. Now, when I was in the exam room with the doctor, I felt like this was my opportunity to speak out, try and escape, you know, the hell that I was trapped in. So I whispered in the doctor's ear that these people were hurting me and I needed help. Well, unbeknownst to me, that the handler or trafficker that had brought me in the emergency room had told the doctor that I was attention-seeking, you know, prone to making up wild stories and accident-prone. So the doctor ended up telling this person that brought me in what I had said.
Oh my God.
So I came back to that same emergency room 3 hours later with 3 broken ribs. And there was another occasion that—
And did you see the same physician?
No, somebody different. And they still just were oblivious and didn't really take an interest. So, and then there was another occasion that I tried to tell one of my teachers, and then that teacher began to molest me. So I had tried to speak out and just, you know, been hit a brick wall at every turn. So, you know, from age 5 to age 12, I went through this hell. And so at the age of 12, I just felt like my life was worthless and there was no way out. So I went to my mother's medicine cabinet, got a bottle of sleeping pills. I went to the liquor cabinet, got a bottle of vodka. I went to my mother's favorite rose garden, which, you know, Cheryl, she cared more about the roses than she did about me. So I laid down in the warm earth and I took the sleeping pills and used the vodka to wash the pills down. And as I drifted off to sleep, I felt this intense sense of calm come over me, a peace I had never known in my life. So at that point, you know, what happened was, you know, I saw a white light and I heard this voice speaking to me saying, you know, your life on earth is, you know, your life here isn't done yet. I want you to go back and fight for every child who's suffering. And in thinking back about the voice, I recognized it as my friend Steve, who was a young boy that had seen strangled to death in front of me. So I woke up in an emergency room to a group of wide-eyed doctors, and a nurse who was there happened to notice that, you know, that there were very clear signs I was being abused. So it was that particular day in my life that I was finally able to escape being a victim of child sex trafficking.
Because of that nurse who was aware enough and, like yes. you said, trusted her gut. And what did she do or say? And did they take you from your family? What happened then, Jerome?
You know, she was able to notify social services, and I was able to get out of that environment. But she was just such a kind person. As a child, you know, someone who genuinely is caring and just, you know, wants you to have, you know, happiness, they're so rare. So I was so thankful for her. And, you know, I was so honored that, you know, last year I was the keynote speaker at the International Conference of Forensic Nurses. And I just thank them so much for all the work they do. But, you know, I was put on a path that day that has allowed me to help somebody break their silence. And I'm so thankful. I feel so blessed every day to be able to do this work.
Jerome, what a difference you're making with your life and your story. To have come full circle like that and to have been able to acknowledge this entire organization of forensic nurses, what a beautiful way to pay it back. So you're taken out of the home. What do you do from age 12 moving forward to get on your own two feet?
Bounce around for a while. And then at the age of 17, actually the day after I turned 17, I joined the United States Marine Corps and never looked back. So I was able to get out of that situation, get out of that area and just start my life all over again. So I'm just so thankful for, you know, God and the United States Marine Corps for, you know, for giving me a new life. And so, you know, in the Marine Corps, you know, I found a new family. In the men and women who served with me, and I just, you know, I'm just so thankful to this day that I have so many brothers and sisters around the world in the Marine Corps, and it was such an amazing experience for me.
What a gift. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
So how did you do the healing? Was it the mission on your heart that did it for you? How did you get from the place of being victimized to this victorious state in which you find yourself living now?
You know, and gosh, Cheryl, you know this, a lot of hard work. But again, I just want to say, you know, I would not be here, period, if it wasn't for a survivor like you. Because someone like you who saw what I was struggling with, you know, saw me struggling with being a man and talking about what happened to me, she was able to guide me through that process of relinquishing, you know, that grip of fear that said if I talked about being a victim as a man, I was less of a man. So she taught me that I could be a man and be a victim and be powerless. And it didn't take away from my manhood. So she really, you know, was an angel who, you know, put me on this path to healing and advocacy and really kept me from spiraling into, you know, being, you know, an alcoholic that was headed for not a good end. So I'm so thankful to be put on that path. But, you know, again, you know, it was God, United States Marine Corps, but I also spent, you know, 25 years with a trauma therapist who really helped me kind of recover and deal with, you know, what I suffered through as a child. And, you know, for those of us who have gone through therapy, you know, it was so much hard work. And, you know, and it, oftentimes, you know, I turn to my therapist and say, isn't there something you can do to make this go faster? Because, you know, I just wanted to get past this. But, you know, Cheryl, there were patterns in my life that just led me to therapy. And one of those was, you know, I called myself a chaos junkie because I would choose relationships that would just crash and burn dramatically. So I would choose people subconsciously that were just the worst people in the world for me to be with in terms of compatibility. So, you know, argue and fight. And so things would always fall apart. So I was recreating the chaos of my past constantly. So I had to acknowledge these patterns that had formed in my life. So I got to a point where I just knew it had to change. So I ended up, you know, starting therapy and spending this 25 years healing. But I will tell you emphatically that the number one healing force in my life has been my children, because, you know, my children have really taught me what unconditional love is. And they teach me again every single day. And one of the things about, you know, being a victim and being a survivor is that, you know, when your children reach that age that you were, when you were first victimized, it becomes a whole other level of healing. Because for so long, and you understand this, Cheryl, I blame myself for what happened. You know, I felt like I should have been able to do something. But then when my children reached the age of 5, I understood that, you know, there was absolutely nothing a 25-pound, you know, child could do against a 250-pound man. So I released that blame. You know, it's that process, you know, that how you're groomed, to blame yourself. So I let go of that. But my children really have healed me, and my wife, they have healed me, and the happiness I have. Because, you know, Rachel, Cheryl, one of the things that you have to really understand is, you know, is that family doesn't have to be biological. It can be operational. So you can start your own family again with people who are nurturing and who really care about you. And I thank God for my family every single day.
Are your children old enough, Jerome, that they know your story yet?
No, you know, and Cheryl, that's one of the things is that I've told them, you know, briefly about it. But it's something that, you know, I'm hoping when I finish my book that's kind of my legacy to them. They can read about it. But, and you understand this, I do everything in my power to kind of shield them from the darkness in this world. So I just tell them that, you know, I had a difficult childhood and that my parents were, you know, my mom wasn't very nice. So I just let them know that, you know, there were difficulties in my childhood, but, you know, the realities of what happened to me, I think would horrify so many people who actually do this work. And some people who have been horrified by what I've told them. So I just let them know that I had a difficult childhood, but just, you know, don't get them involved in that incredible darkness that I suffered through.
Understandable. It's the proverbial walking of the tightrope to inform those loved ones without traumatizing them. And it's something we have to traverse as we speak to liberate ourselves, to make sure we don't imprison our loved ones because they go through their own secondary level of trauma by knowing that we have faced this. So I can appreciate the complexity of that.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I just want to say, and this is why, I thank you for your courage. One of the things that people understand about victims and survivors is that so many of us for a period of time, when we've held that secret, you know, we really feel like that if we tell another human being what we went through, they're going to run the other direction. That they're going to really think that we're, you know, that we have all this baggage. That they're not going to be with us. But it's just the opposite. You know, when you share, you know, what you went through, I think there's that trust that you earn with others, and I think they really begin to admire, you know, what you've gone through, what you've achieved. Because I know, you know, for me and for you, there are some days where, you know, you look back on what happened, and you just, you can't believe that you survived and that you're here today to talk about it. So I think, again, you know, I just feel lucky, and I just, you know, I just really want to make sure that not one more child suffers as I did as a child.
Amen to that mission. Yes. So in terms of the advocacy work you do now, how did you get into that? And tell us about the different things that you provide now that only you are equipped to provide.
Right. Great question. You know, and it's funny because what happened was is, you know, I had been going through therapy. And then in 2011, Jerry Sandusky came into the news. You know, Jerry Sandusky had molested, you know, countless boys as an assistant coach at Penn State. So when Jerry Sandusky went on trial, something inside me said, you've got to speak out. You can't let, you know, you can't keep this to yourself anymore, because I really not spoken about it outside of therapy and close friends. So I sat down and wrote an article called An End to Silence. And I sent that article out to the news outlets, and it was actually picked up by the Washington Times. And they said, you know, we'd like to publish this on a one-time basis in our community section, and we can't pay you. And I said, that's fine. So they published it, and it did so well. They came back and said, well, hey, how about you write a column for us, you know, on a weekly basis? And I said, great, as long as I can do child advocacy. And so that launched me into, you know, being a public figure and speaking out. And, you know, Cheryl, one of the things that, gosh, I know you too, I was so overwhelmed with gratitude, because when I wrote that article, I began to be contacted by people in South Africa, you know, in the UK, that said, thank you. You just told my story that I've never been able to speak about. So from that point on, you know, my career as an advocate began to develop. You know, I began to be asked to speak. I began to be asked to consult with law enforcement. And I've just been so incredibly just privileged to work with the people that I do. And, you know, I actually was so amazed. You know, I actually was asked to speak in France before the Council of Europe on the International Day of the Child. I was there with survivors from 10 other countries, and I got to share my story. I spoke at the United Nations, you know, I've been in Congress. So it's been an incredible journey. And, you know, and the work that we do, it's just so meaningful, because, you know, there are so many victims out there that just need help. And so, and one of the things, you know, Cheryl, you have to understand about being a victim of human trafficking is that you are just terrified of law enforcement, because, you know, you're told as a victim that if you go to the police, or if police find you, they're going to lock you up, even as a child. So you're terrified of law enforcement. So many victims, you know, won't speak to law enforcement. And one of the things that, you know, we also need to frame this with is that, you know, almost every single victim of human trafficking doesn't understand they're a victim of human trafficking. So when you go and ask a victim, are you being trafficked? They have no idea what you're talking about, because it's such a continuum of exploitation. And they don't understand what's happening to them. is wrong. And I think that, again, that's where you and I working together through this broadcast and others, you know, help raise that awareness and just let people know that's not okay. So again, it's about giving permission to victims to speak out, letting them know it's okay. You know, I had so many people come to me when I speak at conferences and say, you know what, until I heard you tell your story, I didn't realize I was being trafficked. So again, it's about letting people know that what happened to them wasn't right and that it wasn't their fault. So again, you know, being able to speak out, being able to show people, you know, that letting go of this secret, letting go of this pain can give them a better life and they can begin to heal from it. And I've just been so honored. And, you know, through my work with Trafficking America Task Force, I've worked on 3 congressional bills, working on one right now with substance abuse, the use of controlled substances as a tool to control victims of human trafficking. I was very honored. You know, I was part of the coalition of advocates, survivors, congressmen and women and nonprofits that helped shut Backpage.com down, which was the largest online brothel in the world. You know, we lobbied Congress to amend legislation that began to hold Backpage accountable for their actions. So we were able to shut them down. I worked in Florida where I live to change the age of consent from 13 to 17 or 13 to 18. You know, in Georgia, it's 11, which is egregious. But, you know, I also worked in Florida to make education about human trafficking mandatory in public schools. So I educate middle and high school students on human trafficking. We also worked to get pornography declared a public health crisis in the state of Florida. And again, you know, in addition, you know, we have state mandated training for all hotel workers. So I was part of the training program for hotel workers in the state of Florida to help them recognize victims of human trafficking, including male victims. So it's been an incredible journey. And you know, one of the things, unfortunately, is, you know, during the pandemic, traffickers and sexual predators have just found a real rich environment for them to go after kids. So we've been doing a lot of education on how to protect your kids online and how to recognize, you know, if your child's being groomed, because, you know, when kids are stuck at home during the pandemic, or, you know, they're at home at other times, they can be actually victimized by human traffickers and sexual predators. In fact, since the beginning of the pandemic, the National Center for Mixed and Exploited Children have tracked a 106% increase in child exploitation material online. And Europol, which is the equivalent of the FBI in the UK, has seen a doubling of child exploitation online in the UK. So there's a lot of exploitation going on during the pandemic. And, you know, we're definitely working very hard to give parents, give lawmakers the knowledge they need to help protect children and help stop the next victim of human trafficking from being exploited.
Jerome, the work you do is essential. Thank you. Will you please share with us all of the relevant links to anything we can use to continue our education, what this looks like, how to spot it, how to help, what to do if we see someone who is being victimized or we suspect that's the case? If you give us those links, we'll place them here in the episode notes. I think that would be invaluable for people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and definitely, you know, our website, you know, if you just Google Trafficking America Task Force, we have a lot of resources there, as well as links to the National Human Trafficking Hotline, which is 24/7, 200 languages. And there's no bad call to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. I worked with, and I tend to work with, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is just a phenomenal organization. I mean, their recovery rate, Cheryl, it's like 90%. And I have a very close friend that works with them in child sex trafficking. So there's no wrong call to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, because, when a child goes missing, there's no waiting period. Immediately, action needs to be taken. So if a child goes missing, and you call law enforcement and they aren't on top of it right away, call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and I'll give you that link and number, and they will immediately get involved and help. They also have a cyber tip line that if you see online exploitation of children, you can call in, and they will investigate it. You know, there are so many kids who are being victimized, you know, over social media and aren't speaking out about it, that, you know, we need to actually, you know, be the eyes and ears of the community and just bring that to someone's attention. But again, you know, awareness and education is so incredibly key because, you know, you don't know exactly who's being victimized, who's suffering until they speak out about it. So I'm just so incredibly grateful for you, the work you're doing, for this opportunity to be on your podcast, because, you know, and I know that there are going to be so many people listening to this that are going to not only want to take action, but also want to come out and share their stories. And I just can't thank you enough for being such an angel and a beacon of hope for so many.
Well, Jerome, I thank you. And I receive your acknowledgement. And at the same time, I have to say, for many years, I said nothing, like so many survivors, but it got to a point where the silence became deafening.
Yep.
Because I became crystal clear that there are so many who can't speak. And the fact that I had recovered and yet was silent, I was unwilling to live with that burden. So it's a necessity. And it, you know, I started it not out of courage, and I thank you for acknowledging me for that, but I didn't do it because of any courage. I did it because the silence was crushing my soul.
Yep.
And that Maya Angelou quote again is just so beautifully said. There's no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I was living in true agony. I thought for so many years, I can't tell people, they'll know how ruined I am. And at that point, I didn't give a damn. I had to tell, or I would continue to suffer a worse fate than I had gone through by the silence. So I thank you for the acknowledgement, but it's not that. And I know for so many who are hurting and feel like they can't share, if that's you, there are those with whom you can share. There are safe spaces. And if you can't find any, if there's no groups you can find, if survivors are beautiful, Facebook groups and different things like that. But if you can't find anybody, reach out to me and Jerome. I mean, Jerome, I'm just making you available.
No, absolutely. No, but I think there's a really good quote for you right now. And for me, the most powerful weapon on earth is a human soul on fire. And I think we both have a fire in our hearts to fight this scourge, to fight, you know, that, to fight and break the silence. And so I think that, again, is the most powerful weapon. And again, I just appreciate you. And you know, I think that, you know, for both of us, I think that voice inside us that became louder to break the silence and just kind of, you know, find our strength, you know, find our power, which we both have. I really hope and pray that through this podcast and through our work, we can give that to every victim. Because I just, you know, you and I both understand, you know, how it feels to keep this inside, to keep that burden inside you. And one of the things I want to say, and that is so important, is that for both of us, you know, in speaking out, we took our power back. We took our power back from those who sought to break our spirit, who those who victimized us. And I want to tell everybody listening that when you speak out, you know, you are telling those people that they could not stop you, they could not break you, they could not stop you from being powerful, and they cannot stop any of us from protecting the next person who could be victimized.
Thank you, Jerome. And there are still those who would try and silence you. If you're listening now and have kept your silence, or selectively shared. There are still those who would try and silence us. That's the way it is. They'll post nasty stuff on social media about you if you do share sometimes. But I think it's essential to remember that the vast majority of people will be supportive of you sharing. Yep. And,
you know, and
because you're also liberating them in some way. It's human nature to hold things inside of us that we think are wrong. And when we share something, we liberate others as well. Forgive me, Jerome, please go ahead.
No, sorry. I was going to say, you know, I was at a conference and someone said something at a seminar that kind of stuck with me. And they said that unless you've walked in my shoes, you have no right to criticize me, period. So I think that when you're, a victim and you begin to talk out and go public, I mean, you know, there are always going to be people out there who are just, looking to stop you from talking out, to be malicious. But, you know, you've got to understand you're stronger than that. And that what you have to say is more important. And so that's why they have a block and an unfriend button on social media. And so you block these people, you know, seriously.
Well said.
Because, you know, and because I will tell you, you know, Cheryl, and you know this, I mean, you know, and the most unlikely people will try and silence you. I know that, you know, about 5 years ago, I wrote an article about, you know, how after natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, sexual predators, human traffickers will come in and they'll actually grab women and children because there's such chaos, they can do it without being detected. So I wrote this article and talked about, you know, steps to take to actually protect, children and women who could be victimized. And, you know, I got in an argument with somebody from the UN who, you know, we're talking about the tsunami in Indonesia. And one of the reasons that this came to light was Australian police caught 22 convicted sex offenders getting on a plane going to Banda Aceh, Indonesia to go and kidnap and molest children. So we were talking about it, and this person would not acknowledge. They just said that they didn't believe this was happening. So you're always going to get people who are going to be dissenting, but follow your heart, you know, and understand, you know, truth to power. I mean, you've got truth to power. We both do. So just tell your truth. And one of my other favorite sayings, you know, it's speak the truth, even if your voice shakes. So always speak your truth, because that's going to empower you and empower so many others. And, you know, people like you and I are here to support all those out there who want to speak out. And, you know, and I'm always available, you know, and I'm always here. And I just want to tell every victim, every survivor, that you are loved, that you do matter, that your story does matter, and it will always matter.
Oh, that's a perfect place for us to wrap up today, Jerome. Thank you for sharing your heart and your story, and for being willing to lead this conversation and break the stigma about men sharing their experiences in sex trafficking. Jerome, thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl, and God bless you. And you know, you're just so amazing. And please keep doing what you're doing, because we need you. So I'm here to support you. And I'm looking forward to working together and just really, you know, bringing every survivor out of that prison of silence, so no one suffers if we have.
Amen to that, Jerome. God bless you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know has been taken for sex trafficking, or you suspect that's happening, call 888-373-7888 or text the word HELP to 233-733. With your help, we can stop human trafficking now. To keep up with all of our latest work, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Trafficked Series. Please be sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to our podcast. And listen to our next episode with Renee Brinkerhoff, who is the founder of Valkyrie Racing, and Valkyrie gives, where she races a 1956 Porsche on every continent of the world to raise awareness and donate funds to combat human trafficking. Be sure to check out our episode with Badass Renee. Until then, I am your host, Cheryl Hunter, and we are here to end human trafficking. So remember, if you see something, say something. This is a Conveyor Media production. Host and creator, Cheryl Hunter. Executive producers, Colin Whelan and Rebecca Sermons. Head producer, writer, editor, Celine Beth Calderon. And music by Mickey O'Brien.